Good morning. While I'm thinking about it, if you didn't see The Daily Show last night, Peter Schiff was on. And so it'll be on the Comedy Central website soon, I'm sure. And, sorry? It's not on? Move it up. Is that better? Okay, I want to talk about the socialist calculation debate. There's a lot of literature. I'm going to sort of boil it down to the major contributions. And if you think I'm caricaturing Mises or Hayek or caricaturing the other side, Oscar Lange, etc., there's no substitute for reading the original literature. It's all available on JSTOR, so there's no excuse for not reading it. There we go. Okay, so there's the Bolshevik Revolution. Contrary to popular belief, Lenin did not throw out the Tsar. The Tsar resigned in February. A democratic government took over. The Bolsheviks threw them out. So they've got this plan. Well, they don't really have a plan. They have this commitment to run the economy in a socialist manner. What are they going to do? They're not the only Marxists who are taking power. There's a brief, shortly-lived Hungarian Soviet Republic. There's a Bavarian Soviet Republic. You go to Marxist.org, you can read Lenin's warm letter to the Bavarian communists. Congratulations on your victory. Have you nationalized the banks yet? In Austria, where Mises is, it's not the communists who are in power, but the social democrats who are fairly close. They have a socialization commission. They're talking about nationalizing major industries. It's headed by a guy named Otto Bauer, who had been a member of Mises' seminar, actually. And in local government in Vienna, the city was known as Red Vienna because it was dominated by socialists. They built a new housing project, which they called the Karl Marx House. So it gives you an idea of the ideological tenor of the day. So it's not surprising that Mises would have thought that socialism is an important issue we need to address. But here's the problem the Bolsheviks are facing. They're committed to running an economy on Marxist principles, but what does that mean? Because Marx himself didn't want to spell out what it would mean to run the economy on Marxist principles. He made fun of the socialists who actually tried to implement something called them utopians. Made fun of people like Robert Owen, who said, here's how we should organize our communities. And the socialists who actually were scientific in the sense of trying an experiment, right? Setting up a community like New Harmony and trying to do collective farming voluntarily. Of course, it failed miserably. The most interesting account recently is Joshua Moravchik's book, Heaven on Earth. It's interesting because Moravchik used to be a socialist, and then he said, well, he looked at the evidence. but Marx ridiculed these people as utopians when they, of course, were the ones who were actually being scientific about it. But Marx said, no, scientific socialism is we criticize everything that's wrong with capitalism. And then we don't exactly specify what goes in its place. There are some hints in the Communist Manifesto and in Capital that there's going to be nationalization and there's going to be a central plan. But exactly on what principles, never spelled out. So Mises is responding to the ideas of Bauer and to the Bolshevik Revolution and asking, is this going to work? Is this feasible? And in his 1920 article, which has been mentioned before, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, he's really addressing the sort of most naive Marxist ideas that all we have to do is institute a plan and we can replicate all the production that takes place under a capitalist economy, but we can, you know, do it more humanely and distribute it more fairly. the debate becomes more sophisticated through the, you know, give and take of socialists responding to Mises' critique. But he says, look, you haven't really grappled with the problem, one of the problems raised by scarcity, and that problem is there are lots of different ways to try to produce goods. Even if you knew what consumer goods you wanted to produce, there are lots of different techniques of production you might use. What mechanism do you have for choosing the least wasteful way of producing things? Right? Socialism, in Mises' understanding, which was the common standard understanding at the time, was you're going to eliminate private ownership in the means of production. Right? You're going to have communal ownership or social ownership or government ownership of the means of production. Factories, machines, raw materials. But when you do that, you abolish the market for those things. I call them inputs, just to bundle them all together. If you abolish markets for inputs, you won't know how to produce things economically. Socialists tried to answer that challenge, Oskar Lange in particular, and that's the origin of the socialist calculation debate. So here's a way to summarize Mises' argument. Right? So you're going to abolish private property in the means of production. That implies no more competitive bidding by capitalists to hire workers, no more competitive bidding to buy raw materials, to buy machines. And that means you no longer have a way of registering the ideas of different producers about what's the most economical way to produce something. All right, so now you're going to be reduced to one idea. And how do you know that's the right idea? There's no market in which that plan is being tested against rival plans. Right? You're not taking advantage, the way Hayek would later put it, you're not taking advantage of all the knowledge of how to produce things which is dispersed through the, throughout the economy. You're trying to centralize all that knowledge and just choose one plan, but how do you know that's the best plan? So, this is my example. Because I had a picture of a Soviet pin with a tractor on it. How do you know how to use that tractor most effectively? Should you use it to grow corn? Well, the way we figure that out in a market economy is we let the corn growers bid for the tractor against the wheat growers, and we see who has the more valuable use for it by who has the highest bid for it. Right? But if we don't have that mechanism, kind of mechanism for registering different ideas about how the tractor can be used, how do we know? So the socialist calculation argument of Mises is sometimes sort of misgeneralized into the argument that you socialists wouldn't know what consumers want. But that wasn't the argument Mises made. He said, let's spot them the assumption. For the sake of argument, let's assume that they know what consumers want because, you know, they can put goods in a store and see what sells, right? So there's some feedback mechanism there. Let's assume, just for the sake of argument, that they've got the right mix of consumer goods. Right? They can let consumers express their preferences in the stores. Still, you don't know how to produce those goods, right? The argument is focused on the market for producers' goods or means of production or inputs, right? Labor, land, raw materials, machines, and buildings. So you want to, you know how much, let's suppose you know how much corn you want to grow and how much wheat you want to grow and so on. Still, there are lots of different ways to grow corn. How much fertilizer are you going to put on each acre? How much water are you going to put on each acre? How many workers? How many tractors? So what recipe for production is the most efficient to use? You need a contest among producers who have different ideas about how to do that to bring forth, to discover what's the most effective way of doing that. In a later debate in the 70s, when these ideas of planning came back again, Vasily Leontief being one of the proponents of national planning, Hayek said, look, suppose you have a lumber storage yard. Should you cover the wood with a plastic tarp or a cloth tarp or build a roof over it? Right? Those are all possible ways of doing it, but you need to look at prices to tell you which one is the most efficient way of doing it. the least wasteful way of doing it. Now, Mises was being generous, spotting the assumption that they could get the consumer goods right, because in practice, this is a butcher shop in the Soviet Union where, right, there's nothing in 4 out of 5 bins, and you probably don't want what's in the 5th bin. They also failed to get consumer goods right, and the most sort of dramatic account of that is Sheila Fitzpatrick's book, Everyday Stalinism. So you find out what life is really like under Stalin. But basically, there are shortages of everything. So in order to sort of clarify what he's saying can't be done, Mises says, look, I'm not saying that you can never plan production in the absence of markets. If you've got Robinson Crusoe, right, there's no market. He's just planning for his own production, for his own consumption. He says, well, he can do that. Right, but he can do that because, right, if he's deciding whether he wants to use a particular piece of land as a hunting ground or whether he wants to clear it and grow crops, he's got the information he needs about his own preferences. So we know the mix of consumer goods he wants. And he has all the information anybody on the island has about the production trade-offs because he's the only guy on the island. Right, so there's no point in having a market. He's going to do as well as he can do. He can figure out, you know, how much, if he knows, how much labor it takes to produce one crop rather than another. He can ask himself, do I want the food or do I want to enjoy more leisure? And so he can consult his own preferences in that regard. So he can figure out what's worth doing. But if you have a society with lots of producers and lots of consumers, you've got a different problem. You want to make the most effective use of the information that anybody has, this is the way Hayek would later put it, then you need to have a market in production goods. So the way Mises put it was only market pricing, quote, enables us to extend to all goods of a higher order, right? That higher order is Menger's term for production inputs, the judgment of value. Right? So you, from the fact that you know, from the assumption that you know what goods consumers want, it doesn't immediately follow how you should produce them. It's a different problem, right? So without a market in goods in means of production, all production involving processes stretching well back in time, and all the longer roundabout processes of capitalistic production would be gropings in the dark. So this is a way of saying there are different ways of producing things. They involve different amounts of time and roundaboutness, our phrase we can't get away from. If you don't have market signals, if you don't have competitive bidding for these resources, you're groping in the dark about which is the best way to go about producing things. So if you want power, should you build a hydroelectric dam or should you dig coal? Right? If you don't have prices to refer to, how do you know? Right, so there are great archives of Soviet posters online. This one says, this is our profit. That's 1 ruble. So calculation by exchange value furnishes a control over the appropriate employment of goods. This is kind of the kernel of the argument. If a producer finds that he will not be able to produce profitably, this shows that others understand how to make a better use of the goods of higher order in question. All right? In other words, if you can't make a profit, then you're not using the inputs right. You're doing something wrong, as Mike Munger likes to say. Now, this is sort of an elementary point, but it's sometimes not obvious to people why, if you can't make a profit, you're wasting resources. So let me make it crushingly obvious with an example. All right, so we got 2 entrepreneurs. Each one borrows $20,000 from the bank, buys $10,000 in cement, and buys $10,000 in labor. They combine them. But they build different things. One builds a swimming pool, one builds a tennis court. So Smith pays $20,000 and he's got a bank loan that he has to repay, so we add $100 for interest. He sells the swimming pool for $20,000, he's made a $1,000 loss. Sorry, $21,000, right? So he's made a $1,000 loss. Jones, who builds the tennis court, sells it for $22,000, He's made a $1,000 profit. So how is it that the fact that Smith made a loss, how does that tell us that Jones had a better use for the resources? Well, the reason Smith had to pay $10,000 for the labor and for the cement was that other people could turn them into $22,000 worth of output. That's why other people, Jones in this case, were willing to bid the prices up to $10,000. That's why the $10,000 price for the input is telling us something. It's telling us how valuable it is in some other use. Right? It's another illustration of the cost of production being a reflection of the demand for those resources in alternative uses. All right, so if Smith is adding less value, to put it in a sort of crude way, it's because other people know better how to turn those resources into valuable outputs than he does. He's building the wrong thing. So that's the profit and loss test that tells producers whether they're using resources effectively. How is socialism going to replicate that? If you have a profit and loss test, then you can decentralize decision making. Right? Because that way we monitor, well, not we, but the market process monitors what uses are being made of resources and gives the users a signal. The way Mises put this was the intellectual division of labor would not be possible without some system of calculating production and without economy. So here's my sports metaphor. In American football, you can either have a player on the field, the quarterback, decide what plays to run in the huddle. You're familiar with American football, right? It's a series of violent events separated by committee meetings. In these committee meetings, the quarterback can decide what play to run next, or the coach on the sideline can decide what play to run next and signal to the players through complicated semaphores what they should do. So who makes the decision, the coach or the player on the field? Well, there's a test for which system works better, which one helps the team win, right? Which one gains more yardage, which one scores more points. So we have a test for whether letting the quarterback call the plays works. And we have a test for whether letting the quarterback improvise at the line of scrimmage, known as an audible, whether that works. So you review a few games and you can see whether the audibles did better than cases in which the quarterback wasn't improvising. And you can tell him, stop doing that, it's not working. Right? So there's a test. If you have that kind of test, then you can allow decentralized decision making because you've got feedback as to whether it's working. So the way Hayek would put this, I guess I've mentioned before, there is knowledge about ways to do things that's decentralized throughout the economy. We can let people use their particular bits of knowledge because we have a test as to whether they're doing that effectively. Socialism doesn't have anything like that. Mises says, okay, if they're abolishing competitive markets for inputs, then they're trying to calculate, if at all, without prices. He calls that in natura, right? Some kind of natural units. Says, is that feasible? He says, well, it's feasible only at the consumption level, right? Consumers can choose, even in the absence of a price system, whether they want coconuts or bananas or what mix of consumer goods. But it's not going to work when you get to goods of higher order. As soon as one gives up the conception of a freely established monetary price for goods of a higher order, rational production becomes completely impossible. So, implication of that, you don't want to go that way. Every step that takes us from private ownership of the means of production and from the use of money also takes us away from rational economics. They actually tried in the Soviet Union to abolish money. Right? All the accounts were going to be kept in some kind of labor units, right? Not in monetary units. If you're not going to have competitive bidding for factors of production, if they're just going to be assigned or allocated centrally, you know, why do you need money? You don't. The factory managers don't need to buy inputs; they're just assigned to them. Now, the argument is not that if you have any kind of government ownership you can't assess whether it's doing a profitable job. If you've got a small enough unit, if you've got a municipal bus line, you can ask, what did they pay for the buses? What did they pay their drivers? What were their expenses? What were their revenues? Did they make a profit? And of course, the answer is no, because if they could make a profit, it would be a private bus line. But you can assess how much money they're losing, right? And likewise, private business firms are sort of islands of central allocation within a market economy, right? So they can't afford to waste resources because they can't afford to lose money, and they can gauge whether they're losing money, right? They know what they pay for the inputs. We can measure what they sell, what their revenue is. We can judge whether they're profitable. And Mises was willing to say, well, even a socialist economy as a whole, if it's using world prices, which, you know, may not be exactly appropriate to the local situation, but they're kind of might provide some rough guidelines, you can judge whether the output of that economy is growing or shrinking. They can have some rough guidance as long as there are other prices out there for the resources they're using. Says we're really in trouble when the whole world becomes centrally planned. So we don't want to move in that direction. But, yeah, okay. So why can't we just use accounting by labor units, say some kind of non-monetary natural unit? Mises says, well, basically because the labor theory of value is not true. The labor theory of value does not give us an appropriate guide to what resources are worth, right? What the foregone product we could have had from using a resource is not reflected by how much labor it took to produce. In particular, he cites the value of raw materials is not accounted for by how much labor it took to produce them. Right? The value of oil in the ground took no labor to produce, and yet you don't want to waste it. It doesn't mean it's valueless just because it's a gift of nature. Likewise, plots of land. Right? You need to allocate land to its most valuable uses. It's not indifferent as to how you use land, and yet you can't decide how valuable it is based on how much labor it took to produce an acre of land. It didn't take any labor to produce it. Second problem, there isn't any natural unit of labor. It comes in very different qualities. And of course, the labor theory of value, when it tried to deal with that problem, dealt with it by cheating. If a laborer pays twice as much, let's assume he's got two effective units of labor. Well, wait a minute, you're backing that out of the price he's being paid. You're backing that out of the wage rate. It's not explaining the wage rate. So labor time valuation is no substitute for market pricing. And the classic critique of the labor theory of value is provided by Bombaver, his book, The Karl Marx and the Close of His System, or a better translation would be On the Completion of the Marxian System. So when volume 3 of Capital is published, Bombaverk says, okay, there's a basic problem in the labor theory of value. You want to explain relative prices by labor input, but you also want to claim that there's equalization of the rate of return in all activities. Marx promised us he would make those two things consistent. This is sometimes known as the transformation problem. He didn't do it. Here's volume 3, and he didn't do it. He's right. And simple example, you could have two production processes. They use the same amount of labor. Say one's growing grapes and one's growing apples. The grapes arrive a year from now. The apple trees start yielding fruit 5 years from now. They've got the same labor input. You can't sell the grapes for the same amount as the apples, because if you do, the rate of return on the apple investment, which took 5 years, is not the same as the rate of return on the grape investment, which only took 1 year. So it can't be that the prices of those two outputs are proportional to the labor inputs, because you're not equalizing the rate of return when they use different amounts of time. So except in a world where all production processes last 1 year and that's it, there's no flexibility about that, it's not going to work. The example I like to use with students is Glenlivet Scotch. Right, comes in 12-year, 15-year, and 18-year. Which one costs the most? They take the same amount of labor to put the, right, the whatever it is before it's whiskey, to put the grain, the mash, whatever it is, into the barrel. It takes the same amount of labor to produce the barrel. So at that point, all the costs are equal. It's just how long you wait to consume the whiskey. Right? You got to pay more for the 18-year. Is it worth it? Well, that's up to you. Okay. Now there's another problem famously associated with socialism, and that is lack of incentive to work. Right? The old joke is, they pretend to pay us and we pretend to work. That is a problem. Experience shows that that's a major problem. Is it more fundamental than the calculation problem? I don't know. They're both important problems. I mean, Mises said that the calculation problem is more fundamental because your workers could work as hard as you would like them to, and they could still be doing the wrong things, and so you still have a wasteful economy. But of course, it works the other way too. You could have somehow magically solved the calculation problem, and if you can't get your workers to work, your output is poor. So they're both important. And in practice, the motivation problem was important in the Soviet Union. So here's Mises in a nutshell. Where there's no free market, there's no pricing mechanism. Where there's no pricing mechanism, there's no economic calculation. And that's pricing mechanism with respect to factors of production. Oscar Lange, sort of leader of the opposition, said, yeah, we accept that you need a pricing mechanism. Lange is a neoclassical economist. He says, we understand the need for a pricing mechanism to allocate resources, but we don't accept that you need a free market to have a pricing mechanism. We can have a centrally planned pricing mechanism. This is why it's called market socialism. So here's Lange at the top. And Lange, in his article on the economic theory of socialism, begins with a witticism. He says, as an expression of gratitude for the great service rendered by Mises, and as a memento of the importance of sound economic accounting, a statue of Professor Mises ought to occupy an honorable place in the great hall of the Ministry of Socialization, or the Central Planning Board of the Socialist State. And here's, so here's the bust of Mises, which, sort of in honor of this joke, some supporters of Mises actually had produced and presented to, after the Berlin Wall fell, to the planning ministries in, I forget where, Poland maybe. Because Lange is a neoclassical economist, he agrees with Mises that a labor theory of value is not going to cut it. Right? That's not a good way to register what resources are worth. So that won't give us the right pricing. We need something more sophisticated. We need a planning ministry. And what will the planning ministry do? They will solve basically a general equilibrium model for determining prices. So Lange basically describes It's not a phone call. It's my reminder to take my pills. He sort of sets forth first-year graduate microeconomics in his article, as of 1936, and says, here's what basically Walrasian economics. We have a problem of choosing between different alternatives. Here's what we need to know. We need to have a preference scale, right, a utility function. We need to have knowledge of the terms on which alternatives are offered. So we need a production possibility frontier. Three, we need knowledge of the amount of resources available. And here's the key statement. Those three data given, just given, and Hayek would later ask, given by whom? Given to whom? And in fact, Hayek made a fun of this statement. This phrase, data given. You know what data means in Latin? Thing given. Right? So to say that the data is given is a, what do they call it in rhetoric? A pleonasm. It's redundant. But if you emphasize that it's given enough, right, so then you have it. The problem of choice is soluble. So what does that mean? Well, we write out the constrained optimization problem, right? We find the optimum conditions, we equate at the margin, bingo. Mises says, look, even if I spot you that you know the preference scale, right? You want to serve consumers and you know what consumers want. And even if I spot you that you have an inventory of how much coal you've got, how many workers you've got, and so on, you still haven't solved, you still don't know the terms on which alternatives are offered. Notice the passive voice. Who's offering them? You need markets to know the terms, at least the best terms, right, on which alternatives are offered. But Lange says, no, no, two is, quote, determined ultimately by the technical possibilities of transformation of one commodity into another, i.e. by the production functions. You know the joke about people stranded on a desert island and they've got a can of beans and no way to open it. And one guy says, well, if we toss it into the fire, it'll explode. No, no, too messy. And the economist says, look, let's assume a can opener. Lange is assuming a can opener. Right? We know the production functions. Problem solved. Well, problem solved once we confront them with the preference functions. He says, look, no reason socialist managers shouldn't know their production functions. Right? The guy overlooking the factory floor in the socialist factory has the same view as the manager overlooking the factory floor in the capitalist factory. What's the problem? Hayek says, look, it's not just knowing a recipe. It's knowing the best recipe. Yet that is not given. We don't know the best recipe until competition reveals to us who had the best recipe. Right? We need a competitive struggle for the resources before we establish which is the best recipe for producing. So how do we determine prices for inputs? Lange says, well, we can do it the way a capitalist market does it, or the way he thought a capitalist market does it, by trial and error. So we could, in principle, just begin with a random price for cement. And if there's a shortage, well, wait a minute, who's demanding cement? Well, the factory owners are. Sorry, the factory managers are. And on what basis are they demanding cement? Well, we tell them, produce at the efficient point. So then they know how much cement they need. At various prices, right? Because they can re-optimize if you change the price of cement. So if there's a shortage, you raise the price. If there's a surplus, you lower the price. This is what the Walrasian auctioneer does. And eventually you home in on the equilibrium price. And as Walras showed us, there is a consistent set of equilibrium prices that emerges from solving the relevant equations. So the Central Planning Board, Lange says, would, quote, fix price so as to satisfy the objective equilibrium conditions. So he's back to a kind of classical notion of the economy being determined by objective conditions, right? The idea that relative prices are technically determined basically takes you back to the classical idea that there's one flat line production possibility frontier. So if you know the slope, then you know the relative price. Demand has nothing to do with it. Preferences have nothing to do with it. So they fix the price to satisfy the objective equilibrium conditions, just as a competitive market does. I mean, Walrasians, if you take their language literally, think of the market as literally an equation-solving device. And Lange, in a later essay, says, in fact, it's a crude, primitive equation-solving device. Nowadays, we have computers. Why should we use markets? So they said, look, in the Walrasian perfectly competitive model, everybody's a price taker. Right? The factory, people running factories are all price takers. Well, we can replicate that. And now we're giving them the prices. So it's operating the same way the managers in a perfectly competitive market operate. Be lucky I cropped, be glad I cropped the picture because it went all the way down to the floor. If you look carefully at the blackboard, right, he's got the marginal rate of substitution between goats and sheep. The caption to the picture was, the mathematical economist has no clothes, right? Like the famous emperor. So does it follow from the the Walrasian picture of the economy as a big equation-solving device, that the Central Planning Board can replicate what the Walrasian auctioneer does. That's what Lange says solves the problem. Mises and Hayek say, look, equation solving is not what markets do. Right? You've got to have the right equations first. The Central Planning Board wouldn't know the relevant equations in the sense that they wouldn't know the least cost way to produce things. To know that, they would have to aggregate all the information about production that anybody in the economy has, and they can't do that. There was some discussion about whether they can solve the equations in real time, right, or in a timely manner. And that's sort of a second order condition. I mean, that, okay, if you had all the information and fed it into a supercomputer, that's not, you could solve that problem. But that's not the problem. The problem is, you know, garbage in, garbage out. You're putting garbage in unless you have a market test for what are the least cost ways of producing things. Now, at this point, you might be asking, well, what's better about socialism if it just replicates what a competitive market does? And Lange addresses that question in his famous article. He says, look, we're not just going to mimic what a free market does. We're going to improve on it because we can redistribute wealth however we like and then figure out how to reprice things. So we can redistribute endowments. We don't have to accept the outcome of last round of market incomes. We can set prices to internalize externalities. Right? So we can not just base prices on private calculations the way the market does. We can base them on social benefit and social cost. We can eliminate monopoly, right? Just by fiat. If the state owns everything, that eliminates monopoly. And here's the one that I really like. We're going to have more technological progress. I don't think history has been too kind to that prediction, but his view was that the owners of factories, existing factories under capitalism, have an incentive to stop technological progress because it makes what they own obsolete. Right? But we're not going to allow that kind of obstructionism under socialism. We're going to always be on the technical cutting edge. Now, here's an amusing footnote. So Lange is just a theorist. He's writing articles. He's teaching at the University of Chicago. He's originally from Poland. Poland is conquered by the Soviets, and after the war is in the Soviet bloc, and Lange is invited to move back to Poland in 1948 and become chairman of the Polish Economic Council. So a chance to actually participate in planning the new market order, sorry, the new economic order. So did he institute market socialism when he moved back to Poland? Did any country in the Soviet bloc? And the answer is, right, so did they decentralize, ask managers to act as price takers, ask them to optimize, have simulated profit accounting, have trial and error price setting? No, they didn't do any of those things. They just followed the Stalinist model of saying, here's your quota, here are your inputs, and here's your output quota, and if you don't meet your quota, well, we have negative incentives for you. To the extent they used any prices in the Polish economy, they used world prices. They sort of tried to behave as an island in a market economy. Lange himself wrote things saying, this market socialist model is not really applicable. We can't do it here in Poland. We need to use the Stalinist model. And as far as I know, never fessed up to the fact that he was contradicting everything he'd written in the 30s. If somebody can find his explanation of the consistency between these two, I'd be interested to see it. So what's the rebuttal to Lange's argument? Well, the immediate rebuttal is taken up by Hayek, but since I've been talking about Mises, Mises responds kind of belatedly in Human Action and says, look, Lange's picture is one where the factory managers are encouraged to bid for resources based on being instructed to produce at the point of least cost. It says, but that's not the same as a capitalist entrepreneurs who are bidding with their own resources. Right? So in the marketplace, you have a system where profit makers are rewarded, loss makers are weeded out. And if you did that under socialism, what you're calling socialism, if the factory managers were able to get rich by keeping their profits, that's capitalism again. It's no longer socialism. Right? You have private ownership of the means of production in that case. So, as Mises put it, one cannot play speculation and investment. If the speculators and investors are exposing their own wealth, that makes them responsible to consumers, the ultimate bosses of the capitalist economy. If one relieves them of this responsibility, right, if it's not their personal wealth at stake, one deprives them of their very character. And to continue, Mises said, look, getting the factory to optimize at the margin is not the problem. It's the big decisions. It's which industries do we begin? Which factories do we open? How do we establish firms? So the socialists are thinking that everything's going to continue pretty much as it was the day before they socialized it. But the big decisions are, what new firms do we open? What new lines of business do we engage in? What factories do we have to close down because they're no longer profitable? It's these financial transactions that direct production into these channels in which it satisfies the most urgent wants of the consumers in the best possible way. Nobody, meaning Longo or any of his compatriots, has ever suggested that the socialist commonwealth could invite the promoters and speculators to continue their speculations and then deliver their profits to the common chest. I mean, nobody's so naive as to say, yeah, we let speculators do their thing, steering resources into the most profitable combinations, and then we relieve them of all their profits and they'd still be happy to go about doing what they're doing. No, that's pretty clear that it wouldn't work that way. So sort of an acid test for Mises as to whether it's a market-directed economy is, do you have these kind of financial transactions? Do you have a stock market? Right? A stock market is how a capitalist economy makes these big decisions about what firms to open, what firms to close. If you don't have that, then you're not a full-fledged capitalist economy. Right? If government investment banks are making those decisions, then we can call it a socialist economy. So this is the sort of key institution that a capitalist economy has that a socialist economy lacks, speculative financial markets. And Longa simply overlooked all that because there isn't any financial market in the Walrasian general equilibrium model, right? As Longa assumed, the list of production possibilities is just given. Production functions are just given, and you optimize given this information. Right? But you miss the fact that it has to be generated. So here's a concrete example. Well, not concrete. I already used concrete. Here's another specific example. Should you produce Velcro? How does the capitalist system decide? Well, we let the decision be made in a decentralized way. Right? Doesn't that lead to chaos? Well, no. We have a way of disciplining people who make the wrong decision. Right? But we allow people who have the idea that this is a good enterprise to undertake, take the risk of investing their own money in it. And if they don't personally have the wealth, then they can raise it from other people if they can convince them that this is a good idea. And you don't have to convince everybody, right? You don't have to convince a majority of the banks to lend you money. You just have to convince one. So even if you lose money as a capitalist entrepreneur, it doesn't necessarily mean you're out for the rest of your life. All you have to do is convince one person to lend you money again. And there are lots of examples of entrepreneurs who failed and failed and failed and then finally had a good idea. But right, we weed out people whose ideas don't look like they're going to fly because nobody will lend them money on terms that make it possible. How are you going to replicate that in an economy where the government or the collective owns the means of production? How do you get financing for a new enterprise? If you have state investment banks, how do they decide who to lend money to, and what incentive do they have to gamble on new ideas? Right? What's their reward? What's their penalty? I'll talk in a few minutes about a neoclassical economist named Abram Bergson, who summarized the socialist calculation debate in a way that became the standard interpretation. And this problem eventually came to be recognized by Bergson. Initially, he overlooked it. But the problem of creating the right incentives for changes, for innovations, he sort of belatedly, after observing the Soviet Union in practice, said, yeah, they haven't really come up with an answer to that problem. So the immediate response to Lange is provided by Hayek. So Hayek edits a volume called Collectivist Economic Planning in 1935. There had been some market socialist proposals before 1935, so this volume includes a translation for the first time of Mises' 1920 article, some other anticipations of the problem, and Hayek has a nice introduction and a nice conclusion to the problem, summarizing the debate as of that point. Lange's article is 1936, so it comes after this volume on collectivist economic planning. And then Hayek subsequently responds to Lange. He says, look, Lange wants to solve for input prices through this constrained optimization problem. But we don't know the best recipes because we haven't, if we don't allow rivalry among profit-seeking entrepreneurs. So he's anticipating the response I just attributed to Mises in Human Action. He's telling managers to play at being market entrepreneurs, but that's not going to be as informative as actual markets where people are putting their own wealth at stake. And in his famous article on the use of knowledge in society, 1946, Hayek is more explicit about this, that look, solving equations is not the problem of using knowledge effectively in society. Right, so this math problem, quote, is emphatically not the economic problem which society faces. The data from which the economic calculus starts are never given to the whole society. They're not given to a single mind which could work out all the implications. The knowledge of production functions, right, of ways to produce things, is widely dispersed. And in particular, Hayek says, the market socialists seem to think that all the production knowledge can be summarized in a slim notebook. Right? It's like a textbook summarizes all the elementary knowledge about physics. But it's not like that. You know, if you go down to the micro level, if you go to a particular farm, right, the guy who lives on that farm knows better how sensitive output is to rainfall, to temperature, to different kinds of fertilizer, how he should respond to contingencies that haven't even arisen. So, you know, if you asked him to give you a complete list of the optimal combinations of everything under every possible constellation of prices, I mean, he couldn't do that. He hasn't done that. He has no reason to sit down and spend his time doing that. But if the constellation of prices changes, then he can figure out an appropriate response to that. But that kind of knowledge, and as later writers like Don Lavoie would emphasize, some of that knowledge is tacit. That is, even if you asked people to write down all possible responses to all possible contingencies, they couldn't do it. They haven't thought of it yet. They can do it if the need arises. So you can't centralize and synthesize all that knowledge. And there certainly isn't just one production function that applies to all farms. Right? Conditions are different times and places. Even more than that, it's not, calling it knowledge is maybe the wrong noun. It's conjectural. People have hunches about how things ought to be produced going forward. Right? They have knowledge of what happened and how it worked out, but conditions keep changing. People have hunches about what new enterprises ought to be launched. It's not really knowledge. It needs to be tested. It needs to be tested in a marketplace to see whether it really makes a profit. So, summarizing Hayek's article, quote, the economic problem of society is a problem of the utilization of knowledge which is not given to anyone in its totality. So, if you accept that that's the fact, we've got a choice between two alternative ways of organizing things. We try to centralize all the knowledge, or we provide a way for people to use their decentralized knowledge and steer them so that they coordinate their plans with other plans in the economy. So this becomes the question, who plans for whom? Right? It's not the case that you have a planned economy under socialism and you have a chaotic economy under capitalism. You have an unplanned economy. People have plans under capitalism, but there are thousands of plans, but there are plans that are coordinated. So this is the way Hayek summarizes the choice. Are we more likely to succeed in putting at the disposal of a single central authority all the knowledge which ought to be used but which is initially dispersed? Or are we going to be more successful in conveying to the individuals such additional knowledge as they need in order to enable them to fit their plans with those of others? So, I know the technical possibilities of my farm, but I don't know what to produce until I get a signal as to what I have to pay for the inputs and what I can sell the outputs for. That's what the price system does. The price system conveys additional knowledge to producers that they need to make their plans mesh with other plans. Right, so that's how we coordinate in a market economy, through the price system. And Hayek has this beautiful example of how the price system conveys information. The example of the tin mine. He says, suppose a tin mine collapses. He says, alternatively, we could assume that there's some new use for tin that is invented. It doesn't really matter from the point of view of most existing tin users, and it's significant that it doesn't matter. All they need to know is that tin is now more scarce. So how do they get that information? Well, they get that information by the price of tin going up. Right? So the centralized knowledge alternative would be, okay, we got less tin, we need to cut back somewhere. How do we decide where to cut back? Well, we have to identify every user of tin and ask them to give us a list of your uses of tin, right? Every way you're now using tin. Then we centralize all that knowledge and we say, okay, which are the least important of these 10 million uses of tin? And cross them out at the bottom of the list. And then send everybody a new instruction. Okay, you have to eliminate uses B, F, and Q. You have to eliminate uses 2, 3, and 7. No, we don't have to do that. In a market economy, we let the price of tin rise, and then each producer says, oh, which are my least valuable uses of tin? Which uses of tin no longer are worth doing given that tin is more expensive? In which cases can I substitute aluminum and, you know, that's now the more effective way to go? Where do I have closer substitutes? Which activities should I give up entirely? So when we do that, we let the people on the spot who know which are the least valuable uses of tin for them, decide which ones are no longer worth the cost. So, remarkably, without any overall plan, but with just decentralized decision making, only the least valuable uses of tin are the ones sacrificed, right? Which is exactly what you would like to do from the perspective of an optimizing social planner, but which you don't really have the information to do. So the market price system does it for us. And Hayek says, look, you really have to step back and say, wow, that's pretty amazing. The price system is actually a marvel. If somebody had invented it, we would say he was a genius. Of course, nobody invented it. It emerged. And in fact, civilization wouldn't have been possible if we didn't have coordination through market prices. So, we look at the price system as a mechanism for communicating information if we want to understand its real function. And this idea, this sort of theme, has been picked up by some neoclassical economists. And some of the flavor has been distilled out of it. In the Nobel Prize to the people responsible for mechanism design a couple years ago, Eric Maskin and those folks, some of them cited Hayek as an inspiration for their work. But the fact that they're designing mechanisms right, as opposed to studying evolved mechanisms, should tell you that there's a limit to the Hayekian-ness of their research program. The division of labor and thus our very civilization would not have arisen except that we, quote, happened to stumble on a method which made it possible, namely market price system. All right, so to drive the price system to reveal accurate information, we need competition. All right, so I referred to this in my first lecture, that in this debate, Hayek and Mises began to realize that it had never been fully spelled out why we need markets. Right? They had assumed that all neoclassical economists understood this. But now they realize that if you just focus on equilibrium, you're not really getting a full picture of how markets work. So Lange's proposal, Hayek says, could only be possible in somebody who was excessively preoccupied with the pure theory of stationary equilibrium, right? Stationary equilibrium being, you've got all the things you need to solve the problem given to you, and it's just a matter of cranking through the Lagrangian to find the optimum. And much later, and this is an exception to what I said, that Hayek didn't do any economics between 41 and 76. This is a very important exception. He wrote an essay on competition as a discovery procedure, in which he says, look, we have to use competition to overcome our ignorance, right? Our ignorance of how different things will work out. So he uses the analogy of sporting events, or test-taking, or auctions. It would be absurd to sponsor a contest if we knew in advance who the winner would be. Right? So market socialism is saying we're replicating competition, right? But they've already, it's already implicit in the equations what the answer is, so it isn't really competition to find out what the answer is. But that's the marvelous thing about competition. It tells us the answer, who's the best competitor, which plan is the most profitable, when we don't know beforehand. And that's the theme taken up by Kirzner in discussion of the role of the entrepreneurial function. Right? To discover opportunities for increasing the effectiveness, the efficiency with which resources are being used, and to test the hypothesis that I've found a profit opportunity. So, does everybody agree that Mises was right now that the Berlin Wall has fallen and the Soviet economy has fallen apart? Well, some former socialists have come to that conclusion, and Robert Heilbronner, of the worldly philosopher's fame, is one of the most prominent, who in 1990 says, it turns out, of course, that Mises was right. Well, nice of you to say so. Unfortunately, you're saying so for the wrong reason. I mean, you've really just revealed that you didn't understand Mises all along. Because the fact that a mixed economy island in a world economy of prices fell apart when it had been, you know, limping along for 70-some years, adopting Western technologies, using Western shadow prices, allowing some markets, having all kinds of black markets, that's what kept the system chugging, well, not limping along, allowing private food production and so on. That's not exactly the pure socialist economy falling apart. That's some kind of patched together interventionist economy falling apart. The better evidence is back in 1920 when Lenin actually tried pure communism, tried abolishing money, tried doing everything by decree, and it was a complete disaster. And the switch to what was called the new economic policy in 1921 was an admission that, the pure marketless economy was not going to fly. So in the Soviet Union, they allowed private businesses back again. They allowed people to hire workers on their farms again. And that was later modified by Stalin's five-year plans, but the Soviet Union after that point was not a pure socialist economy of the kind that Mises was criticizing. So here's the standard summary of the debate that I mentioned from Bergson. This is an article entitled Socialist Economics, 1948. And it was reprinted in several American Economic Association volumes of the important articles in comparative systems, comparative economic systems. So it became the standard account of the debate and is the target of Don Lavoie's dissertation, which provides a new interpretation of the debate, more like the one I'm providing. On the question of Heilbronner, Heilbronner's book, The Worldly Philosophers, of course, is sort of the best-selling textbook in the history of economic thought. This slideshow I'm giving you is sort of taken from a book on the history of thought I'm in the process of writing. My working title is The Clash of Economic Ideas, because, you know, there's long been a debate between pro-market economists and anti-market economists. So I'm focusing on the big policy debates and the big policy experiments of the last 100 years. I used to say of the 20th century, but a publisher told me, no, that's not going to sell. Say the last 100 years. Okay. When I started this about a year and a half ago, some people said to me, you're talking about socialism, nationalization, that's a dead issue. Nobody's ever going to propose that again. I guess I'd better publish soon before it's too late. But so I would like there to be a non-socialist Heilbronner, right? An account of economic history not written by a socialist. All right. So Bergson says, look, Mises provided this theoretical argument, and Lange smashed it. Lange showed, look, the optimization problem under a socialist economy is the same as the optimization problem, right? It's the same set of equations that Walras gave us. So in response to that, all Hayek could do would say, well, you don't have enough computers. This is Bergson's interpretation, right? There are practical objections, too many equations, too slow. But Bergson said, look, there can hardly be any room for debate. Right? Who could deny this? Of course socialism can work. On this, Lange is certainly convincing. Right? So if we can solve a system of simultaneous equations, of course socialism can work. Once tastes and techniques are given, sorry, once they're given, that's the whole debate. How are they given? How are they discovered? Where are they coming from? But once they're given, the values of the means of production can be determined unambiguously by imputation without the intervention of a market process. There's actually a debate early on in the 20s, before Hayek comes under Mises' influence, where Hayek, following Wieser, thinks that the prices of the means of production can be solved for by imputation without referring to any market process. And Hayek, I don't think, ever really remembered that later on, but implicitly he discovers that his own position in the 20s had been a little too naive. The Central Planning Board could decide readily how to allocate resources so as to assure the optimum welfare. It would simply have to solve the equations, right? So these are Bergson's own words. I'm not caricaturing him to say that he thinks it's an equation-solving issue. So that became the standard summary of the debate. Later on, Bergson had some second thoughts. Right? He looked at what the Soviet Union was actually doing and saying, well, you know, the managers are not behaving the way they're supposed to behave. They're not just acting like profit maximizers. They're actually cheating. They're actually buying things in black markets, and they're misreporting what they're producing. And it's very difficult for anybody to hold them accountable because they're cooking the books. And in this article, Market Socialism Revisited, said, well, maybe there is a problem of, you know, telling managers, pretend you're a profit maximizer. Said, we don't really have a satisfactory test of success. And even if we did, we have to give the managers incentives related to it appropriately. You know, come to think of it, Hayek argued that such a result might not be easy to achieve. In particular, managers would be likely to be reluctant to take risks. Right? They don't want to be sent to the gulag, so the safest thing to do is just repeat what you did last period. Why engage in some new enterprise? Because you don't get to keep the rewards if it turns out to be profitable. But if it turns out to be a mistake, you may suffer consequences. This is perhaps not inevitable, but the construction of a satisfactory incentive system now appears to be more difficult than I envisaged it to be previously. Maybe they were onto something. I mean, he has a very limited grasp of what the problem is, but at least he's recognizing that there's some problem. Here's another case, Paul Samuelson. His second thoughts were more about the actual performance of the Soviet economy than about the socialist calculation debate, but it's fun to make fun of him anyway. In his textbook, Economics, which went through many, many editions, right up to 1989, he proclaims, the Soviet economy is proof that contrary to what many skeptics had earlier believed, that means Mises and Hayek, a socialist command economy can function and even thrive. And we know this based on the Soviet Union's official statistics about how much they're producing. 1995 edition. Soviet central planning is the failed model. Gee, what happened? Maybe not only the factory managers were cooking the books, but the Politburo was cooking the books. Okay, questions? Yeah.
In your first or second slide, you talked about the unintended externalities that socialism strives to address.
Right.
What is the Austrian reply kind of to that? Because it wasn't addressed, and I just kind of would like to hear kind of how you would address it.
Okay, so how does a market economy deal with externalities?
Yeah.
Well, that's a big question.
Yeah.
That takes a whole nother lecture on public goods and externalities. But I guess the traditional market approach is to distinguish between externalities that involve physical invasions of people's property and treat them as property right invasions and address them through tort law. Distinguish those from other kinds of externalities which are not invasions of your property. So, for example, under the theory of externality, if somebody would be willing to pay you to marry a new spouse because they don't like your current spouse, that counts as an externality. Anything they're willing to pay for, right? And if there isn't, for some reason, if there's a missing market so they don't get to bribe you, then there's a market problem. The example I like to use, I used to own a 1963 Ford Falcon Futura convertible. So it looked kind of cool. It was pretty expensive to keep running. But when I drove down the street, people would say, yeah, thumbs up, cool car. And I would say, yeah, could you toss me some money to help keep it running? And they never did. So I was being under-rewarded for providing this positive externality.
Well said.
Yeah. But so we need to worry about sort of physical transgressions. We need to worry about pollution.
Yeah,
so the traditional way to deal with that is through the legal system to treat it as an invasion. Now, there are great, grave practical problems. You know, the simple case is one polluter, one victim. Then it's easy to solve. One polluter, many victims, it's a little harder. You need a class action suit or something like it. And you need some way to constrain your tort system so that it doesn't get out of hand. Speaking of pollution. Many polluters, many victims, right, like auto pollution, big problem. But the approach ought to be to treat it as something which can be enjoined or for which compensation is due. So that ought to be the model. Now, how that works out in practice is a problem, but it's a problem under any system,
yeah.
Right? And just saying we're going to treat it as a Pigouvian problem and arrive at the optimal tax, that's hand-waving. as much as any other proposed solution. I mean, but that would be sort of a broad framework for how to deal with externalities. So positive externalities I don't regard as a problem, except as an entrepreneurial problem, which is you have to figure out some way to get people to pay for it. That's your problem as an entrepreneur, right? You want to provide cable TV, you got to figure out how to get people to pay for it. Okay, well, they have solved that problem. No, fortunately or unfortunately, you don't have to buy it. But you know, some negative externalities, I don't want to call them negative externalities, I want to call them, you know, torts. it's a challenge to develop the tort law system to deal with them, but you know, if we had allowed the common law to evolve from the beginning instead of trying to override it with central planning, I mean, judges thinking, well, yeah, this brick factory is dumping soot on people who were there first, but really bricks are socially more important than these pig farmers, so we're going to allow it. Well, that took us down the wrong path to where it's now become a very difficult problem.
I wasn't sure from what you said if you thought that Karl Marx was just a bitter man and he was lamenting about capitalism, or if he merely intended his ideas on socialism to be an intellectual exercise and he expected people to take his ideas seriously. Topic is on socialism, but you were speaking about communism, and could you please address this European model? Because I mean, socialism, it's very obvious that it collapsed, but the European model has been around for a while. And we don't have recommended readings.
Okay. Well, I gave you some... So the question was, what about recommended readings? I apologize for not providing those in advance, but I gave you some during the talk, and so my recommended readings would be Mises' article, Economic Calculation in the Socialist Commonwealth, Hayek's Use of Knowledge in Society, Lange's On the Economics of Socialism. Those would be the most important. Right, so your first question was, was Marx serious, or was he just a sort of intellectual, doing an intellectual exercise, or was he serious about having people put his ideas into practice? He was serious, right? He wrote the Communist Manifesto. It's a manifesto. He was a political activist. He was engaged in party politics all the time. So he was serious, but I think he was cagey. He realized he didn't have a blueprint for the socialist economy. So he confined himself to critiques of the capitalist economy, and once we seize power, then we can figure out what to replace it with. So am I accusing him of a certain amount of wishful thinking? Yeah, I guess I am. Secondly, you asked me to about the distinction between communism and socialism, and what about the European model of socialism? Well, right, so by socialism, I mean an economy in which the government or some collective owns the means of production, as opposed to having dispersed private ownership of the means of production. So, okay, communism has failed. Well, to Marx, right, communism was a form of socialism. The distinction isn't really important for the socialist calculation debate. But I'm not sure what you mean by the European model, but if you mean Sweden, Sweden is not a socialist economy. Sweden is a capitalist economy with a high tax rate, right? But they've got private ownership of the means of production. They've got a stock market, right? They have a large welfare state. A welfare state is not socialism according to the definition, the standard definition of collective ownership of the means of production. Right, so we need, if we don't like a large welfare state, we need a different argument. It's not the socialist calculation debate that demolishes that. Right? But they have a price system in Sweden. They're guided by the price system. In fact, they have lower corporate taxes in Sweden than we have in the United States. So in some ways, it's a more capitalist economy. What was your last question?
That was it.
Okay. In the way back.
How do you think China's hybrid economic system fits into the debate?
How does China fit into this debate? Well, yeah, good question. I would need to know more about the particulars of the way things work in China, but as I understand it, they have been, through sort of fits and starts, turning resources over from the Communist Party central management to more decentralized ownership. The process involves, you know, favoritism and corruption and competing factions of generals and so on, but nonetheless, it's moving in the direction of more decentralized ownership and therefore direction by profit and loss rather than by central allocation. So I mean, I think that explains why there's been such tremendous real growth in China. Right? They've been moving from a system in which resources were being terribly wasted to one in which there's a process for weeding out waste, stopping production of things that don't pay, and moving to profit-oriented production. So we may not like the process because it wasn't, you know, sort of privatization by some kind of fair voucher program, but at least it's some kind of privatization, and we can hope that, you know, they're moving in the reverse direction on the road from serfdom, and that more political freedom will result eventually as a consequence. But it's clear that the standard of living has risen as a consequence of this. So it sort of passes that crude test of providing benefits to ordinary citizens. I mean, there's been an incredible alleviation of really bad poverty in China and in India. You know, so one of the sort of often overlooked aspects of this sort of capitalist or quasi-capitalist movement in China and India has been a vast reduction in the amount of gross inequality in the world, because the poorest people in the world have started to enjoy a more decent standard of living. There may be other people here who know more about China than I do. Yeah.
Why do you think is it that the classical economists have tended to overlook the fact that these means are not given? Because I think like the first one who defined economic science is the science that that deals with the fact that you use scarce means to satisfy non-dual ends was Lyman Robbins. His work was very much influenced by Austrian ideas, right?
Right.
So, did he misinterpret or misunderstood what they were talking about?
Okay, so, yeah, that's a good question. Right, so the question is, the market socialists seem to have overlooked that the production possibilities are not just given to us. But in overlooking it, aren't they following Lionel Robbins, who defined economics as the study of the allocation of scarce means among competing ends? And wasn't Robbins influenced by the early Austrians? Robbins was influenced by the early Austrians, but in a sense, the Austrians, as of 1932, when Robbins wrote his book, hadn't fully realized their own message, hadn't fully expressed it. And I've been saying this right for the last few days, that it's in the socialist calculation debate that Austrians realized that they had a message that was different from neoclassicals, that constrained optimization wasn't enough to explain what it is that markets do for us. Right? They don't just solve equations for us, they discover and test hypotheses people have about the best way to produce things. So Robbins can be excused for not having picked that up, because it was pretty deeply buried and implicit in what Mises had written at that point, and Hayek had written very little at that point about knowledge problems, right? He had only written about business cycles. So it hadn't, the Austrians hadn't really dug it out of their own thinking and made it more explicit. But it is wrapped up with this idea that economics is only about allocation, right? This Robbinsian maximizing is what Kirzner calls it. And if that's all you think economics is about, then you completely overlook the entrepreneur, you completely overlook the discovery process, you completely overlook the question of how institutions that are useful to us evolve in a decentralized way. Because, right, when you sit down to write constrained optimization problems, that's all given. Right? The institutional background is all there. It's a very ahistorical approach, a non-entrepreneurial approach. So these problems of the neglect of the entrepreneur, and the neglect of the discovery process, the idea that all the information we need is given, those are all linked problems. Yeah?
This is a question about subsidies. What do you think of the collectivist notion of public education? Is government subsidy harmful or helpful in education and the market process?
Okay, so what do I think about government subsidy of education?
Yeah.
This is only very tangentially related to the socialist calculation debate, but it is a nationalized industry, or municipalized or statized, whatever, governmentalized industry, and that is a problem. I mean, it's a problem of the profit and loss test not operating to weed out inefficient ways of you. You don't even want to call it education, schooling, right? Weeding out inefficient means of schooling. Well, inefficient according to whom? Well, if our objective is to provide what the people who would be paying for it in a market system want, parents, basically, you know, we have a very ineffective system. When it comes to publicly provided schooling. So there is a certain amount of shopping around. If you don't like the schools your kid is in, you can sell your house and move to a different school district. Right? But that's a pretty high barrier to shopping around. And so it would be nice if we could decouple those two things. You shouldn't have to sell your house in order to move your kid to a better school. If you can afford private education, then you shop around among all the schools that are within reasonable distance, and you can do that. And there are good private schools that compete for students. One of the problems they face, though, is that they have licensing requirements from state governments, which are dreamed up by educational bureaucrats who are trained in schools of education, who respond to the fact that government funds the large majority of all education. So the same dumbing down that you find in public schools, you're now finding in private schools. But in a market-oriented system, you know, like Adam Smith suggested, you know, the pupils should pay, or their parents should pay for their education, there would be more of a discovery process, and there would be a lot more variety, right, like you find in private schools. There are Montessori schools where the kids don't have to wear shoes. There are schools where the kids have to wear uniforms. There's lots of choice. And I think we would have a more interesting society. One of the things I find encouraging is the growth of homeschooling, because the homeschool kids I meet are, you know, more interesting and more mature.
Thank you.
And it's sort of the acid test for whether you actually learn anything useful by being socialized in a public school. But yeah, I mean, it's a problem that we have this entire industry which is run by bureaucratic criteria and not consumer-driven. So there are various strategies for trying to move it toward a more consumer-driven model, and I don't want to get into that debate over whether vouchers are on net good or evil, but if we got to a system where parents were paying, like we have in higher education, more or less, right, we would have better results. Right? American higher education is sort of the best in the world. American high schools, nowhere near the top of the ladder. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
What kind of competition went on back then, and how did, was it more of a collective system, or was it more of a...
Oh, well, I'm pretty weak on ancient Chinese history, but I know a little about Greece and Rome, and they were definitely market economies, right? And sort of the growth of civilization is the growth of trade. When Greek city-states start, you know, moving beyond their own city walls and start trading from island to island and across the Mediterranean, you know, they start learning new things. They start learning about new products, new ways of doing things, new ideas. So it's not just, you know, crude goods and services that result from the exchange between people living in different circumstances, but new ideas come in. But it's through trade that you get division of labor, right? You can't afford to specialize in something unless you can sell it. So if there's no trade, there's no division of labor. And so these things grow together, division of labor, trade, the emergence of money, and the spread of ideas from place to place. So, you know, that's what I mean by civilization.
You said ancient China. How about just before the Communist Revolution?
Before the Communist Revolution, as far as I know, China was a sort of heavily interventionist economy, but basically a market economy. You know, it wasn't a centrally planned economy. And there were the usual political struggles over who was going to control it. But, I mean, famously, there was the Mandarin system of a heavily bureaucratic state, and it restrained Chinese economic growth during that period. And it's with the opening to trade, opening to the West, that sort of very traditional hierarchical societies like China and Japan became integrated into the world economy. And you know, became open to more liberal policy ideas.
It struck me when you said that, because I was thinking about this kind of wall that people were. I mean, it was very, it seemed that Japan, I think, also was very fun. They didn't want to, and yet they seemed to have developed rather good civilization. Maybe not very equal, but they certainly made a lot of advances.
Yeah, I mean, my, like I say, I'm not an expert in ancient China or Japan, but my strong suspicion would be that these are feudal societies, if we go back far enough, much like Western feudal societies, but even in the West, under feudalism, there's a civilizing role played by markets, right? If you just had monks in a monastery producing for themselves, what would they do? They would just keep reproducing the Bible. There wouldn't be a growth in knowledge, right? It's when they start selling their brandy, start hiring people to work for them, they become enterprises, that the Renaissance becomes possible. Right? It's, I mean, the Renaissance in the West is definitely associated with the growth of trade. Right? With the best, speaking of recommended readings, best short thing to read about this is Henri Perrin's, what is it? Something in the Growth of Cities. Anybody know the title? I forget. Civilization and the Growth of Cities? Anyway, I mean, he talks about how what we call the Dark Ages is associated with a period of low trade, right? Because the security necessary for trade has vanished, and the Mediterranean's been shut down by Islam, and so Europe has sort of become isolated and self-contained, and it's a period of stagnation of Western civilization. And when trade reopens,